The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Last week we looked at the science of the later stages of life, and now we're going back to the beginning. We'll look at the changing ways that medicine, science, and culture have treated childbirth throughout history with Randy Hutter Epstein, author of Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. But first, let's discuss what you think you know about life expectancy. It's time for another installment of Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong with Greg Layden. Greg is a biological anthropologist and author of Greg Layden's blog, Culture as Science, Science as Culture. Welcome back, Greg.
Thanks. Great to be back.
So as with all of your Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong segments, we're dealing with something that you call falsehoods, statements that people assume are correct. And it's not really that they're incorrect. It's just that the issue is more complicated than it seems.
Exactly. We're making a particular falsehood indicates a belief in something or an idea or misinformation that by examining it, we can sort of parse it out, find out what it is, and you know, kind of bust it.
So today's falsehood is about life expectancy, specifically the idea that life expectancy in the past was less than what it is today. So what's the problem with that?
One way to put it is actually to sort of take the statement, you know, a person who's, say, 40 years old makes a statement, if this was the Stone Age, I'd be dead by now. And that kind of means two different things to people. One is that in the Stone Age, people didn't live to 40, and now they do. Or a person saying this has had some experience in their life recently, usually, in which they've had their life saved by medicine. You know, they've had a disease and they got treatment for it. Or they imagine the vaccines they've had have saved them from various diseases. Or they had a surgery of some kind that we wouldn't have been able to get in the Stone Age. So they're alive because of their living in the modern era. And there's a lot of reasons why this is a falsehood. And if first of all, it is probably true. There's certain people today who are 40, 50 years old who would not be alive in the Stone Age. But it isn't inevitable, it isn't everybody, and it isn't as bad as people think it is. For one thing, people are confusing life expectancy with a kind of lifespan. So if you say the life expectancy of people living in a certain time was 40 years from birth, that means that when you get to 40 years old, half the people you know are actually still alive. Now, life expectancy is the average number of years that you can expect to live probabilistically from your current age based upon data collected from your context that applies to your cohort, and your usually things like your sex or maybe other factors can be put in there. So a secondary falsehood then is, you know, the first one is just people are confusing life expectancy with lifespan and assuming a life expectancy of 40 years old means that by 41 you're living on borrowed time. And the other part of that is assuming that something that could happen to you today medically wouldn't have happened to you in the Stone Age or that you would have needed to have that happen in the Stone Age.
Right.
I think that's a kind of an important subtlety. If you know, if you get a vaccination, like we vaccinate our children today against all these diseases, well, none of those are Stone Age diseases, pretty much. Most diseases you get today, all humans around the world almost are exposed to the same set of diseases because of globalization. And a lot of those diseases are zoonotic diseases that existed after agriculture was invented. They come from cows or ducks or something. So a lot of our diseases wouldn't apply to Stone Age populations. So that assumption doesn't fit. A lot of our bad things happen to it. Maybe a trauma surgeon saved your life, but maybe the trauma surgeon needed to work on you because you were in a car accident.
Right.
And there weren't any cars in the Stone Age, you know? So the assumption that the Stone Age was a time where everyone died of things quickly and a lot of people died early and died young and infant mortality was high. These are all things that are not simply not demonstrably true.
Well, even life expectancy itself, though, can be considered from two different points. You write that there's life expectancy at birth and then at some later age, often around 12 years old. So why is that the case?
The problem is there's a bimodal, in many societies, there's a bimodal distribution of death. So people die soon after birth or they end up living much longer and then die later on. It's really more complicated than that because you often have peaks of death among, for example, 16 to 25-year-old men die more than younger or older males do. because of accidents and bad behavior and so on. So you get these variable changes. So as you get past these peaks, your life expectancy goes up. Your average life expectancy goes up after you didn't die from an infant's age disease or because you did something dumb when you were 16. So that makes a difference. So obviously, if you're saying life expectancy from birth is at age 40 and you're a person who's 39, that does not apply to you. If there's a high infant mortality, you didn't die when you were an infant. So it doesn't matter that life expectancy at birth in your society or in some Stone Age society was 40. What now matters is what is life expectancy at the age of 39?
Right.
In your group. And it's probably something like 70-something. Okay, so people are saying, if I was living in the Stone Age, my life expectancy would be 40, and I'm 40 now. But no, your life expectancy would not be 40. It would be some other larger number if you're saying that when you are already 40 years old. So that's part of the problem. The other thing is, and this is an issue that I encounter in many other areas besides the question of life expectancy, but is that we have a binary concept of now and then. And it's amazing what many different sources of information people will fit into then. A really egregious example of it came up actually in a comment on my blog post about this, but it's a problem that's been bothering me a lot lately, is that evolutionary psychologists and other people studying human behavior have recently decided to include on their list of hunter-gatherers a bunch of societies that are not hunter-gatherers at all, and they happen to be societies with very high mortality rates due to homicide. So if you look at the data tables that people are using in current papers and talks and so on, homicide rates among hunter-gatherers of the Paleolithic are assumed to be extraordinarily high. And if you remove all the groups that aren't actually hunter-gatherers, there's hardly any groups left for which there's any data. It's really hard to count mortality, and especially homicide-related mortality of hunter-gatherers, because there's so few of them. The total number of hunter-gatherer people that have been studied by hunter-gatherer studiers ever is probably less than 5,000 people.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. How do you estimate life expectancy in, like, the Paleolithic era then?
Well, there's two ways. One is look at modern hunter-gatherers. And like I just said, there's only several thousand people in that sample. And that's only by including all hunter-gatherers in all continents that have ever been studied by anybody.
Right.
And, you know, for example, the project we did in the Itteri Forest with the F.A. Pygmies, we kept track of everybody who was born and died and when they died. So we have good, really good, solid demographic data on a sample of about 200 people for 10 years. Which is just simply not enough to estimate homicide rates. My feeling is when you go and actually live with hunter-gatherers, like I did with the Pygmies or DeVore and Lee and others did with the Bushmen in Botswana, you find out that they have very low rates of violence, very low rates of violent tendencies. They don't seem to be homicidal people. They do not have ritualized violence in their culture. Most African and Latin American hunter-gatherers are pretty mild-mannered. And in fact, in the Congo War recently and in the Namibian War connected to South Africa and Angola in the 70s, hunter-gatherers were recruited into the military to fight, and it was an utter failure. You know, these are not fierce, homicidal people. It's hard to pay them and hire them to kill people. So those of us who study hunter-gatherers have a hard time believing that the Pleistocene was a Hobbesian nightmare with life, you know, nasty, brutish, and short,
right,
and constantly in a state of war. It just wasn't. But that is true of some societies, and those societies have been added to the list to bring up the homicide rate for whatever reason. The other way to do it is to look at damage and cause of death in skeletal remains. And this, I think, is very interesting because there is evidence of violence quite often in the skeletal remains we find. However, if you actually look at what archaeologists study and what they say about the skeletal materials, there was a period back in the 70s when it was really thought that we could get demographic data by looking at houses and storage pits and pottery and skeletal remains and estimate population size and estimate cause of death and estimate life expectancy data for different populations in the past. So people did that, and what they found out was you can't. It's almost impossible to use archaeological data to get good demographic information. And if you look at the references people make now, we have the estimate of lifespan in the Paleolithic of a certain age. If you look at the sources of data, they're mostly from 1970s period publications because that's when people still thought you could maybe do it. And we just don't do it anymore. So there's people who aren't archaeologists citing old studies.
Right.
And I'm not saying it's impossible or that there's not anything out there, but the data just really plain suck, which also leads us to the other problem with the Paleolithic or the before this mythical shift to some other demography and health status is a big, giant, diverse, multi-continental, many tens of thousands of years of time, many cultures, many habitats, many environments. There are probably places where, you know, in a short number of years, everybody died. At the height of the of one of the glacial periods in southern Africa, we find zero archaeological sites over an area the size of, you know, Quebec, where there used to be lots of sites, and then there's no sites, and then they appear again later. Mm-hmm. Everyone was gone. And I bet a lot of them died. It was a desertification event, a very arid period. I bet a lot of people died. So the life expectancy for people living in those disaster times was probably very low. But we also find skeletal populations of tall people, people who are healthy. And also, as I said before, many of the diseases that affect us in recent times didn't affect Paleolithic populations at all, or at least not much. People often also misstate what saves their lives today. I mean, you ask people, how did your life get saved? They'll mention something like a heart bypass, or they were saved by a surgeon after a car accident. They never mention their teeth. But if you took all the 50-year-old North Americans and did their dental history, a large percentage of them would be dead if it was not for dentists. Those abscesses can kill you. If you don't get your wisdom teeth pulled out, they can become abscessed and they can kill you. All kinds of bad dental things can happen to you. We don't credit dentists for saving our lives all the time. When we're talking about if this was a Stone Age, I'd be dead. Many people do, but often people, I think, forget that. And most of those dental problems did not exist in Paleolithic populations.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest is Greg Layden, biological anthropologist and the author of Greg Layden's blog, and we're talking about life expectancy. You've actually made me think that I should probably do a show on dentistry now.
You should.
Thank you.
Yeah, and
that's a good idea.
People often complain about how much my mother-in-law has to have a procedure done that I just had to have done recently as well, an implant. And we're talking about how much it costs. And I realized, well, you know, in the middle of this conversation, it's going to cost, even after insurance covers it, this is going to cost $1,000. But would you pay that for cancer surgery that stopped you from dying from the cancer?
Very good point.
And yes, of course you would. Well, this will kill you too, you know. So in other words, modern Americans, most modern Americans, and of course not the listeners of this show or readers of my blog because they're all very savvy about these things, but many people just don't have any idea what our dangers really are or what they were in the Paleolithic. So making the comparison isn't very useful. But there's another problem too, and that is when we look at modern hunter-gatherers, the ones that have been studied well enough to have some guess as to what their life expectancies are, their life expectancies range from, for women, which is, happens to be what was studied more, from 52 to 58 years, life expectancy at, I think, 15 years of age. That is equivalent to mid-20th century North American women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's happened since the mid-20th century are two major medical changes that have occurred. One is trauma surgery. Many, many people who were in fact left for dead at the scene of car accidents or shootings in 1950 are today routinely saved by trauma surgery.
Right.
There's a big difference. And then using mostly pharmaceutical techniques, we haven't brought people into old age, but we've taken people who are already in old age and made that last a lot longer. People who go into the hospital with congestive heart failure and they get a series of pharmaceutical treatments over a period of 48 hours and they go home. And then they don't come back for 4 or 5 years.
Right. And actually, that makes me think, you know, we usually assume that a longer life expectancy is a signifier of a higher quality of life. Would
right.
you say that's true?
I think it's very true for that middle part, you know, where they drag you out of the car wreck and they get you, bring you back to life, essentially. That's good in that sense, because then you go back to being, you know, just 2 or 3 weeks after we actually met in North Carolina, I had an injury to my knee. That would have made me one of those Paleolithic skeletons that proved that people maybe took care of their kin because his leg had withered off. You know, my leg was virtually almost amputated from the knee down. It's fine now because of things that could not have happened in Paleolithic. And that I would say is definitely an improvement in quality of life because people encounter these injuries and they get through them now. Extending old age, it depends. I mean, I've known people who got past bad periods when they were pretty old. And went along and were nice and happy and everything was fine. Then they died again. Didn't get through it this time. And other people who really basically ended up spending another 5 years sitting alone, blind and deaf and in pain. You know, so I think that's a big question as to how the extension of old age affects us.
So would you say overall that we generally underestimate the life expectancy of past populations?
We definitely do, and we underestimate them even to the extent that people who kind of represent the past populations, living hunter-gatherers that are out there now, we underestimate their lifespan. I mean, when I talk about my work with the FA pygmies, a really common question I get is, but what's their life expectancy? And my answer is, if you go into a group of hunter-gatherers, there will be old people there. you go to a village, there'll be babies, there'll be middle-aged people, and there'll be some old people. You know, and people are kind of expecting you to say, well, their life expectancy is 40 and there's nobody who's 50. But no, there's people who are 70. There's nobody who's 90. There are people who are 70, 75 years old. So I think we definitely, as a culture, we tend to underestimate that, partly because we have this dichotomous view, the past versus now, and the past has one set of characteristics, all of it, and now has one set of characteristics, all of it. And neither one of those is correct. I mean, right now there are hunter-gatherers living on this planet. Right now there are places where people have very shortened life expectancies because they don't have access to modern medicine, but they have plenty of access to disease. Agrarian people living in rural Africa have extremely high infant mortality rates, for example. So life expectancy at birth is really low. And all kinds of infectious diseases exist, and there's no medical treatment whatsoever. So nobody has any anti-malarials, but everybody has malaria. And that's now. There's so many levels at which this kind of thing is misunderstood. We are just us North Americans who are not poor. And them are the nasty, brutish, and short people of the Hobbesian Paleolithic.
Greg, fascinating as always. Thanks very much for being here.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
You can find Greg Layden at scienceblogs.com/Greg Layden or at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. There's also a link to the post that Greg wrote about life expectancy, so if you have questions, head to his blog to ask him. And we'll be right back with Randy Hutter Epstein, author of Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
My guest today is Randy Hutter Epstein, MD. Randy is a medical writer and adjunct professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. She's also the author of Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. Thanks for being here, Randy.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Now, you make it clear in the book that the quest for the perfect child is not new.
Oh, no. You know, it's interesting. When I first started working on the book, my goal was to say, how did we get to where we are today, that we're desperate to make these perfect children? When was the tipping point, which I thought was, I don't know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? But interestingly, as I started to do the research for the book, I realized we really haven't changed in some ways ever since, well, maybe not Eve, but everyone since Eve has been desperately trying whatever way they could to figure out what to do to have the perfect baby. So maybe today it means let's pick this sperm or pick that egg or pick that woman to carry our embryo. But go back hundreds of years ago and the advice books were saying drink this or eat that or think this thought or don't think that thought and that will help create the baby. So in some ways I think it goes to something in human nature that we're desperate to try to control what inevitably is this uncontrollable process.
Tell us about some of the earliest ways that people tried to ensure that they had ideal offspring.
Well, there was this notion in ancient times that good sex made for good babies. And I don't want to go into the details, but reading some of those ancient guidebooks was a little kind of soft porn. They thought that, you know, a woman had to be satisfied. You had to have simultaneous orgasms, and they were instruction books. It's like the same mind-body connection that we believe in today. And so there was a thought that, you know, if you thought angry thoughts during pregnancy, you would have an angry child. Or if you looked at ugly things while you were pregnant, you'd have an ugly baby. So, you know, it sounds silly when we think about it now. But if you think that even today we believe in this mind-body kind of notion, it was really sort of the beginnings of that.
And so you're speaking actually about Serranus. He wrote an early book on gynecology.
He was one of the first, you know, if you go back in ancient times, you know, it's really hard to separate sort of philosophy of medicine and doctors of medicine. So he wrote some of the first guides. And I have to say, when you go back that far, the men that were writing birth books often had never seen a baby born. They were just sort of writing the same stuff that had been said over and over. It's not like doctors today who might do their own research and report on it. The books that were written, in some ways, were scribes. I mean, one of the things I like to point out in my book that a lot of the original books were written by doctors for doctors, you know, in Latin. They really didn't want to reach out to the lay public. One of the first guides that was really available for couples was written by none other than monks. So not only were men writing these books for women about their pregnancy, but here were monks writing this book about women's health and what to do while you were pregnant. And I'm not sure what gave them any kind of authority. I can't imagine that they knew much about women or pregnancy or giving birth. And in this very ancient guidebook written by monks, they did include a section on good sex, making good babies, and had sex advice in their book, too.
Oh, well, why did they think that pleasure was so important to conception?
I don't think it was the pleasure so much, but I think it had to do sort of with the science of it. Maybe they thought that burst of energy somehow was helping sperm and egg unite.
Well, it sounds equitable, which is nice.
Yes, it was actually in a way. I mean, there were even things written that said, if you're not going to satisfy your woman, she won't get pregnant and she'll look elsewhere for a different husband. There wasn't a lot of equity back then, I have to say. Really, the thought then was that men carried the seed of life and that that had everything. It had like a teeny little human in it waiting to just blossom. And women were just sort of the vase with soil. So men had to plant this seed in them, and hopefully it would plant, and women were just sort of these hollow vessels waiting for the baby to grow. So if you go back to ancient times, a lot of the fertility tests had to do with having women squat over these very aromatic incense, and if the same scent came out their nose, you knew that they were barren, because there was nothing in them blocking the scent from going in one way and out the other.
That one struck me, especially.
Because it really kind of showed you what people were thinking about women then.
Right.
There wasn't anything in you but baby-making machinery.
Well, there was another infertility remedy that you wrote about soaking your bits, as it were, in ground stag antlers and cow manure.
When I read about some of those infertility treatments, I mean, I have to say two things. One is, we will be laughed at, I think, in hundreds of years from now when people look at the hormones and what we're doing as infertility treatments. I know they're successful, but someday someone will say, oh, my God, that was crazy. And the other thing, when you think of these horrible things that women were doing to themselves, it really shows how desperate we are and we've always been if we really want to have a baby.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with Randy Hutter Epstein, author of Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. So we've been talking about, we mentioned pleasure, but pain was supposed to be sort of an integral part of the birthing process at one point.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking specifically about the Bible's promotion of...
It had to be painful, right? We're still suffering pain, but we've gotten away from it's part of the process that you have to be in pain. And, you know, we know this started with the biblical notion of Eve eating the apple and God's punishment. But really, it's funny because in some ways it still sort of sticks today. There was definitely the notion originally that many people felt that women should not have pain relief because it was the Christian way of giving birth.
Right.
It was sort of the first rite of passage to becoming a mother. But it is interesting because you talk to women nowadays, and I think we're still judgmental on whether you have natural childbirth or not. And to me, it's, you know, a very personal decision. But I've spoken to so many women in the process of researching Get Me Out. And even today, most of them will say, well, I had the epidural, but I kind of feel guilty. I feel like I have to validate it. So there still is this notion. We don't talk about those being the Christian way, but I still think there's this notion of the valor of going through the pain of natural childbirth.
Speaking of, you know, the pain, could you tell us about the Chamberlain family?
So the Chamberlains' claim to fame is supposedly they were the British midwives, I mean, originally from France, but fled to England, and they discovered the first forceps that worked by getting the baby out in one piece. There was always some tool that if the baby was stuck in the birth canal and you didn't want both mother and baby to die, there were all sorts of really scary-looking instruments. They would get the baby out. The mother would survive, but the baby never did. You know, they'd get the baby out in several pieces. The Chamberlains were this family that came over to England in the late 1500s. And they said, we have this forceps that can get the baby out. You know, gentle to the mother, gentle to the baby. Oddly enough, they decided we're not going to show anyone what our forceps look like because we don't want to share the business. So for generations, they became the midwives to royalty, the midwives to wealthy women. And what they would do is while they used their forceps, we figured out what they look like generations later, they would blindfold the woman while you were in labor, carry this forceps in a huge box that looked like a coffin, and, you know, they'd put a whole tent around the woman, you know, so she couldn't peek or know what was going on, and then they claimed their forceps worked. Now, we think they did work. They kind of looked like two big ladles kind of attached with a screw, so that the ladles would, like, nuzzle around the baby's head.
Oy.
And they were bent in a certain way to, like, ease the baby out of the birth canal. But we didn't keep statistics then. I mean, they certainly didn't. So while word was that if you were in trouble, you really wanted a Chamberlain by your bedside, we really don't know statistically how many lives were saved. Nor do we know how many more lives would have been saved or babies had they shared the design of their forceps and let other people use them.
Well, you mentioned the tent, but at this point in, I guess, gynecological history, men were basically delivering babies blind anyway.
Yes, basically. You know, in 1700s and early 1800s, when men were first starting to come into the labor room, there was this notion that most often it was women, it was female midwives. The men who were trained were called male midwives, and when they came into the birthing room, it was still seemed a little obscene for a man to be there with a woman with her legs spread having a baby come out. So what they would do is they'd put sheets over you in a tent-like fashion, and they would put their hands under the sheet. So, yes, they were delivering a baby without keeping an eye much on what's going on.
That is ridiculous.
It's scary.
I can't. I was trying to figure out sort of the dynamics of that situation at that point.
Well, the dynamic was that a lot of husbands wanted the male expert there because there was this notion he was smarter and he was better than the old granny midwife, but they didn't want that man seeing their wife naked.
Right.
So it sort of maintained the respectability.
Well, what was the relationship between the female midwives and the man midwives?
Not a good one. You know, and it's interesting. In England, they started licensing midwives way before we did here. And there was definitely tension, but the English government finally said, you know, well, then we'll make these granny midwives get licensed and get educated. And that sort of solved some of the problems. But there was a lot of anger. They each thought the others were murdering women and babies. They each thought the other were careless. And both of them had their points. Midwives thought doctors were completely inexperienced, and oftentimes they were. Doctors thought midwives were uneducated, and oftentimes they were. Midwives thought doctors were starting to abuse forceps in the late 1800s, using them when they weren't needed, and they're right. So it sort of was, you know, this back and forth, a lot of tension and a lot of fear that one was trying to take over the other's profession.
We have a question from Cynthia. Did women working as midwives have any impact on women's ability to obtain a medical education when gynecology started becoming a standard medical practice?
Oh, that's such a good question. No, you know, it's really interesting. It wasn't, the midwives were their own group, and a lot of them had a lot of, they learned from their mothers and sisters. A lot of the women that went into gynecology early on were not from midwife families. They were more these feminist women that wanted to become doctors, and once they struggled and were able to get into medical school, either the only specialties that were available to them were women's health, it seemed natural, or that was the field that they felt they wanted to go into because they felt that women needed experts. So it wasn't so much the midwives going off to medical school, but these feminist women who then said, this is the field that I should be in once I was in medical school. In the very first medical schools, OBGYN was like the bottom of the barrel thing to do. It was really, in the early 1900s, doctors were trying to sort of uplift the profession. There was a feeling in, even in the 1800s, like, after going to medical school and after becoming this sort of elite professional, why would you do something that your grandmother has been doing?
Where does the use of forceps stand today now?
When I wrote the book, I think I was given the statistic that about 11% of births forceps are being used. And it's interesting, doctors have said to me, you know, you really learn from your mentors. In some ways, medicine hasn't changed in that way. A lot of people are not teaching, they're not seeing forceps being used. And if you're not learning how to use them or seeing it, you're less inclined. And also, as we know, there's been a huge increase in the amount of cesarean sections. So a lot of doctors will say, oh, the baby's stuck, let's go right to the C-section. Whereas there are still a few doctors around that will say, we could try with forceps before going to the C-section. But I think more often than not, we're jumping and going right to the C-section.
Now, that's speaking about sort of westernized countries.
Mm-hmm.
Elsewhere in the world, forceps are definitely more important.
Yes, and there's been this push, and I don't know how extensive it is now, but I spoke to an organization that does international health care, and one of their missions is to try to train people like in rural outbacks in developing countries to use vacuum extractors, which are pretty simple to use, that sort of cups around the baby's head and sucks them out gently, and forceps, for the reason that you cannot expect every single woman that's miles and miles without good road access to be able to get to a hospital to do
right.
A C-section. So there is this push that why don't we train, you know, not even doctors, we can train the healthcare providers in these rural outbacks to use forceps and vacuum extractors.
Well, continuing on with the controversial figures in gynecological history, let's talk about Dr. J. Marion Sims.
Oh, he's a great one in terms of controversy. Dr. Marion Sims, on the one hand, he did this wonderful thing. He figured out how to sew up women who have vaginal fistulas. Those are the tears that you can get in your birth canal from being in labor for too long. This was a huge problem for rich and poor women alike, you know, before we were doing C-sections. And this is still a huge problem in developing countries now. If you have no access to C-sections and you're in labor for too long, you can get tears and you'll survive the pregnancy, but you'll be incontinent and have, you know, horrible problems, you know, for the rest of your life. So Marion Sims in the 1800s figured out exactly how to sew up the birth canal so that right after birth, women would no longer have these tears and could get on with their life. And he is considered just this huge humanistic guy in the history of childbirth. That doesn't sound very controversial. Here's where the controversy comes in. I wanted to say his good part first.
That's very nice.
How did he figure out how to sew up the birth canal? Well, Marion Sims was a small-town doctor in Alabama, and this was in about, you know, the middle 1800s. And he hated obstetrics, hated anything to do with anything in women's health. He thought it was absolutely disgusting. But all these slave owners kept saying to him, I need to get my women back in working order. Can you help figure out a cure to the vaginal fistulas? So how did he figure out his cure? Well, in a nutshell, he borrowed a few, and I put the word volunteer in heavy quotes. He called them volunteer slaves. And without any anesthesia, he operated on these women in his backyard over and over again for years until he figured out the cure. We know three of the women's names. We don't know much about them, except that they were just these horrible guinea pigs in this gruesome medical experiment.
And that's really the thing now. There is, you know, documentation that says that these women consented to the research, as you said. So what does that mean when you're a slave?
It means nothing. It right. means absolutely nothing. I mean, it means that these women were in horrible shape. They were uneducated. They were illiterate. I'm sure they were very young. I mean, you got pregnant very young then. And having fertile slaves was important. You know, after 1808, we were not allowed to import slaves into the country. So in order to keep the business going, in order to keep your workforce going, we bred slaves. So it was very important to have fertile women. You know, it was like animals. It was like cattle. You wanted to be able to make more of them. So maintaining a woman's fertility was really important. So this was the impetus to heal these slaves. But we know nothing about, you know, these poor women that were just operated on over and over in his backyard. And when he did go up north to present his final success, and he went to a meeting in New York City, he kind of blurred over. You know, I think even in those days he knew he should just sort of mention his findings and not go into the details of how he got there. Now, it's interesting because, you know, obviously people have written a lot about the horrors that have gone on in terms of medical experimentations on slaves, in terms of Irish immigrants. When things have gone awry and you don't get anywhere, it's easy to say this was a horrible person. But because it's weird, Sims actually came up with this cure. And for years we forgot about or we ignored how he got there. And just, you know, there's statues. There's a grand statue of him in New York City that says to this great doctor who did wonderful things.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. Randy Hutter Epstein, MD, is discussing the history of childbirth, and we'll be right back with more of that after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we look at the practical advantages and the ethical pitfalls of using animals in scientific and medical research. We're joined by Janet Stemwittle, Associate Professor of Philosophy at San Jose State University and author of the blog Adventures in Ethics and Science. And we'll talk to Bill Berry, Chief Historian at NASA, about the history of animals and spaceflight. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest today is Randy Hutter Epstein. Randy is a medical writer and adjunct professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. She's also the managing editor of the Yale Journal for Humanities and Medicine and the author of Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. So there's been a lot of back and forth about natural childbirth over the years. So can you give us some historical highlights? And I'd like you to start with twilight sleep, which I had never heard of.
Twilight sleep, it's such a wonderful story. And I'll just say it was a method of giving birth that was popular in Europe. And it was a mix of scopolamine and morphine. It was touted as pain-free childbirth. But really, you were in pain, you just didn't remember it. And of course, that gets into the philosophical question, well, if you don't remember it, were you ever in pain?
Right.
But when I say you were in pain, like women were thrashing about and looked like, you know, they were agonizing, and then they just didn't remember a whit about the birth experience. I mean, this is before natural childbirth, this is unnatural childbirth. In the early 1900s, a group of feminist women from the East Coast heard about twilight sleep in Europe, and they started demanding, we have to have this done here. And it's fascinating when you think of the difference in feminist crusades. Their crusade was, we demand not to remember anything about childbirth. We demand that we should be able to have the drugs that we want. And, you know, they would say, you walk into the hospital one moment, and then the next minute, your baby's in your arms, and you have no idea what happened in between. That's what we want.
I just think this is one of the most fascinating things I've ever heard.
How it came to be is two journalists went over to Germany. That's where it all began. And it just shows how journalists can be a little sloppy at times. They didn't really see a woman have twilight sleep. They went to this gorgeous clinic where women went and stayed for a month or so before they were about to give birth. Then they were given twilight sleep, And the journalists interviewed the women before and after, and they interviewed the doctors. So the doctors told them it's wonderful, it's pain-free. The women said, this is terrific. I went into the hospital and I came out with a baby in my arms. Everything's great. They went back and wrote an article in McCall's. It became hugely popular, and they started a Twilight Sleep Association, and they started to enlist doctors to do Twilight Sleep. Now, at the time, a lot of doctors said, I don't know if you really want to just start giving morphine to women. Too much morphine can really slow respiration. You can die in childbirth. And we weren't good at figuring out the exact dose of scopolamine and morphine. So a lot of doctors were against it. The more doctors were against it, the more these women said they're just lazy, they don't want to try anything new, and the more they fought for Twilight Sleep. And then there were these theories that if you did not remember the birth and if you didn't go through the anxiety and the fear of the whole experience, it was better for the baby. The baby came out and you could hold this baby gently without all that anxiety, and it's better for your health, better for the baby's health. So it became more and more popular. The more popular it got, the angrier doctors got. The angrier doctors got, the more forceful women would get to fight for what they thought was the right thing. And originally in the press was all these glowing stories about painless childbirth and how wonderful Twilight Sleep is. But, you know, when I think you hype things up too much, it's never a good thing. So after Twilight Sleep was written about as wonderful, wonderful, soon some of the truth started to come out. When you were given Twilight Sleep drugs, you were also put in this weird straitjacket, and you were put in a hospital bed that looked like a crib because you were so out of control during childbirth. Sometimes you would kick and flail and knock your head, but you didn't remember any of that. You didn't remember being put in a straitjacket. But sometime a few people started to write about this, and so as the real story started to percolate out, Twilight Sleep got less and less popular. It also didn't help that the president of the Twilight Sleep Association, a woman named Charlotte Carmody from Brooklyn, she died in childbirth while having her fourth child. And her husband was quoted in the New York Times as saying it had nothing to do with Twilight Sleep. But her next door neighbor immediately started the anti-Twilight Sleep Association.
Honestly, this
so that was the start of anti-natural childbirth, I think.
But as you said, this was a feminist campaign. They wanted more control over their own labor, but ultimately how they did that is by giving a doctor all the control over their labor.
Well, it's interesting because I think it shows that when there's not good communication between doctors and patients, we'll, as patients, tend to fight against the doctors for better or for worse. So that's a lot of what was happening. Maybe doctors weren't saying it in such a nice way. They were like, this is really stupid. Don't do Twilight Sleep. That's a
right.
dumb thing that these women are saying. So the more they said that, the more women would fight for it. And it is interesting. In some ways, you could say, well, gosh, women were relinquishing all control to doctors, but they felt they were controlling how they wanted the birth experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's, you know, it's a matter of how you perceive control.
Well, so this was sort of a backlash to potentially doctors' lack of bedside manner. So then we have the...
Exactly what it was. During Twilight Sleep, the doctor had to sit by your side to monitor the drugs and make sure you didn't kick yourself. So a lot of women were saying that's because doctors don't want to sit by our side. So it was a backlash to that.
Well, then we have the backlash to the backlash, really, and that's Lamaze.
Exactly. And, you know, this lovely coincidence, I was chatting with the headmaster of my children's elementary school while I was researching the book, and he said, did you know that the founder of Lamaze lives next door to the school? And I had no idea. I got very friendly with Elizabeth Bingham. I would take her out for lunch. She's in her 90s. She's not quite as lucid now as she was when I was interviewing her for the book. But in those days, Lamaze was such a big thing in the 70s, and she really started in the 40s. And it was not very popular then at all. And the funny thing is, Elizabeth being the founder of Lamaze, when she gave birth, she had every drug available.
I love
and
that.
And this was not before natural. This was in the thick of it. And she said she knew the doctor well. They were having trouble getting the baby out. And she was talking and counting and doing all the Lamaze stuff. And he said to her, I can't stand you, this chatter anymore. I don't even want to hear you. You know, we can't get the baby out. We're giving you drugs.
Right.
It's not something she always liked to publicize. She will claim that Lamaze was never about giving birth without drugs. But if you read their stuff, it sure sounds that way.
Right.
She will say it's really educated childbirth. And in truth, when she first started giving her classes in the 1940s, she really was educated men and women about what was going on in pregnancy. No one ever talked about it then. And, you know, she'd get a few couples that would sort of be blushing and giggling in her little classroom on the Upper West Side of New York. And it didn't really blossom until the feminist crusade of the 1970s, where then celebrities had to not only go to Lamaze, but they wanted Elizabeth Bing to teach them Lamaze. Now, the other interesting thing about the whole Lamaze movement is they named it after Dr. Lamaze, who was a French doctor who promoted this natural childbirth method of counting and relaxation. He could care less about them. She met him once. He ignored her. They adored him because he was the doctor that helped her partner give birth when she was in France. But he just wasn't into women that much, and he really looked down on them, and he could care less that there was this whole movement named after him.
So this was part of the move to demedicalize childbirth then?
Yes, and it was also, you know, saying that their big thing was awake and alert. You know, it was opposite twilight sleep. The women in twilight sleep said, we demand not to have to remember this. The thing in Lamaze was, we can cherish this childbirth experience. And it was interesting because it really became this huge movement, not just a feminist movement, but like a lot of psychoanalysts and the early child psychoanalysts then started to feel that it was better for the baby. You know, that this became then the rooming in, that you should not just give birth naturally, but once the baby's out, the mother should hold the baby right away. The baby should not be whisked away to a nursery. And these first few moments of life, there was this psychoanalytic bend that it set the baby emotionally on a much better path to start life being held by the mother and not by the nurses and not in a nursery.
Well, an extension of that, the logical extension, I guess, are the free birthers.
Oh, they're lovely. They're a group of women who believe that you should give birth without any assistance whatsoever, no midwife, no doctor, no anyone. Just you, your husband, maybe your other kids at home. They think that this is the most stress-free way to give birth, and there are women doing this now. They share advice over the internet in terms of how to cut the umbilical cord and prenatal things. Statistically, it shows overwhelmingly, according to their own statistics, that it's healthy for the baby. But you have to realize that some of these women, while they're giving birth without any assistance at all, if any problems arise, they might rush to a hospital.
Right.
So they don't get counted in the statistics as a free birther.
Right.
So according to the free birthers, anybody that's actually been counted, it's usually a happy ending.
At the risk of sounding like a hippie, there actually could be something to this, could there not? Because being relaxed
in
your own home.
Yeah, you know, look, my personal feeling is that, yes, there's something to relaxing and being stress-free, but I kind of feel, and I have four children, my feeling was if there was a one in a billion chance that my baby might need to be in the neonatal intensive care unit, I wanted the best one down the hall. You know, so it's really a matter of your own risk. So I wanted to be in a hospital. My births were all completely fine. I actually could have been a free birther. I had easy deliveries. And part of me is a little envious of them because I think, oh, it would have been nice just to, like, have them pop out and in my own home. And what a great feeling. But if I had to do it all over again, I would have thought the same thing. I want that good neonatal intensive care unit down the hall.
Personally, just imagining the mess that you would have to clean up makes me want to go to the hospital.
Actually, you don't have to imagine. You can go online and just Google free birthers, and they videotaped their births. My kids came in when I was watching one of them. and they were just like, oh my God, that's so disgusting. You know, a lot of them give birth in, like, the blow-up baby pools.
Right.
And without getting into too gory details, in one or two of them, they gave birth in the baby pool, and then their other toddlers who were around said, Mommy, can I come in the pool with you? And they took off their clothes and joined her in the pool. And I'll just say it was a very pink shade of water by that point. It's about as natural as you can get.
So an audience question from Ben R. What are Randy's thoughts on water birth in terms of safety and efficacy?
The statistics show that they are safe. You know, the baby doesn't then take its first breath until it's out of the water, and it's pretty, you know, it's only in the bath for a second. I just kind of don't get it. The notion is that it's an easier exit for the baby rather than putting them suddenly into the world.
Right.
They go from inside the amniotic fluid to bathtub water to out. But that's where you lose me, because at some point they have to get out of the bathtub too. So I'm not quite sure what that few seconds in the bathtub give them. I don't know if it smooths the transitions so well. You have to get into the world at some point. You have to get out. So I'm not a huge believer of the benefits of it. When I gave birth in England, my doctor said, here's the bathtub. It's next to you. You know, whatever you want. You want to go in at the last minute? Fine. The one thing I do have to say that this was not a water birth. The minute my son got out of me, I got in the bath, and it was so soothing. It was wonderful. It was so relaxing. 2 years later, I gave birth to twins in America, and my doctor said to me, make sure you do not go in a bath for 6 to 8 weeks. And I said, why? I was in a bath the minute my son was born. And he said, well, you know, you're kind of open, and you never know about infections. I'm not going into a lake, you know, it's my own bathtub. And, you know, and then he starts saying, well, I don't want to get sued in case anything happens. So I think sometimes
right.
We have weird policies here in the United States because we're worried about bizarre lawsuits.
We have another question. It's from Donnie. Has anyone ever studied whether epidurals or anesthesia can affect the baby?
Yes, and it's really mixed results. And usually a lot of the studies, when you look back, they're kind of biased. So some of the, there's been studies that claim that epidurals, you know, or anesthesia, it's still in the baby and it could have, you know, it gets into the baby and it can have some long-lasting effects. But we all know women that have had epidurals and anesthesia because of C-sections, and the children seem perfectly fine. So does it maybe get into the baby a bit? Possibly. Do we have any proof that there's any long-term effect? There's really no hardcore solid evidence.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and our guest is Randy Hutter Epstein, MD, author of Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. So we've been talking mainly about childbirth itself, but before that, one has to get pregnant. So let's talk about artificial insemination. How did that start?
People have been fiddling with artificial insemination for longer than we'd think because it was done in secret. And there were doctors in the late 1800s that were scooping up sperm and from husbands and then getting it into women and thinking, you know, that it would get in better from whatever their injection turkey-based or thing they were using. The first time it was written about, or one of the first times, was in the late 1800s when Dr. Marion Sims, the one who did those horrible operations on slaves, he also did stuff with artificial insemination, and he wrote about it in a medical journal, and the medical community was so angry that, you know, because it sounded so obscene. There were also, in the early 1900s, a report of using sperm from a donor to get a woman pregnant. Apparently, a woman was having trouble getting pregnant and went to a doctor, and he used sperm from a medical student, but no one knew. So it was donor sperm, but again, I'm not even sure the woman knew. A lot of times, you know, the doctors would discuss things. They'd knock the woman out with ether, and they just said she was having a fertility treatment. So things were done very hush-hush. Of course, these days, donor sperm is not a secret at all.
I actually didn't realize that it was so difficult to be a sperm donor now.
Oh, you can be accepted to practically anywhere else. But, you know, as journalists like to say, you know, it's easier to get into Harvard than into a sperm bank. I think this year The acceptance rate at Harvard was about 6%. Acceptance rate at California Cryobank, 1%. Now, if you get into Harvard first, it'll help you get into California Cryobank, but not vice versa. If you get into California Cryobank, even though it's so hard to get into, it's not going to be impressive on your college application.
We actually did an entire episode on sperm with Cy Curious a while back, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, and really, the egg deserves some attention. So what's the history there around freezing embryos and eggs?
In a nutshell, basically, we're great at freezing sperm. We've been doing it for a long time. All sperm are a bit of DNA with a tail. That's all a sperm is. It's a simple little thing. We freeze them, we defrost them. Eggs, the largest cell in the human body, are ridiculously complicated and fluid-filled. We're good at freezing them. The trick is it's really tricky to thaw eggs, and we're getting better and better. But I would say it's really only been in the last 5 years, maybe 10 years, that we've really gotten much better. So 20 years ago, there were still doctors saying we'll never be able to thaw eggs. We're getting better and better at it, but it's still tricky business. And then you could say, well, why not just freeze the embryo? Freezing eggs started not so much what you hear of now, women saying, how can I keep my eggs on ice while I grow old so that if I get married at 45, I can use my 20-year-old eggs? The real impetus for freezing eggs started because women in their 20s who were being diagnosed with cancer and doctors saying, we'll cure you, you have to undergo chemotherapy, you'll survive, but you may never be fertile. Let's freeze your eggs, put them on ice while we give you chemotherapy, while we cure you of your cancer, and then at least you'll have this store of untouched eggs that could help get you pregnant. The success rates are still pretty low, but people are doing it.
And I will give Leah B. the last question. How has the growing research around the egg's involvement in conception, active egg versus passive egg, changed the study of fertility drugs?
You know, what really changed was not just the notion that the egg was important, but looking at all the hormones and physiology of women, estrogen, progesterone, the pituitary gland. I mean, it's fascinating research and fascinating history. And what really happened was doctors said, we have to be able to isolate estrogen. We have to be able to make it synthetically. We have to be able to isolate progesterone. We were isolating and trying to hunt down these hormones really before we knew what we were going to do with them. Then we said, ooh, there were doctors saying, you know what, I bet there's a way we can control the menstrual cycle to help women not get pregnant. You know, so, and then there was this other way of, well, we could also maybe fiddle with progesterone and help women boost their fertility. So it was all going on at the same time. Sometimes the same doctors were looking at fertility and contraception at the same time. But it all came about from the fascinating history of hormones.
And we are completely out of time. Randy, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. This was so much fun.
And we didn't get to talk about even a quarter of the fascinating and highly disturbing information that is contained in this book. So you can find Randy Hutter Epstein and Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank at randyhutterepstein.com. There's also a link to it on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, do click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR, 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Lisa Skovanek. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.